Hello, listeners. My name is Dr. Kendra McCray, and I am an associate professor of history in the Atlanta Branch Association for the Study of African American Life in History, or ASALA, representative for Atlanta Metropolitan State College. We have the opportunity to hear from Dr. Maurice Hobson, an associate professor of African American Studies at Georgia State University. Dr. Hobson earned his PhD in history at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, his MA in African American Studies and in American Studies from the University of Alabama, and BA in History and African American Studies from the University of Alabama at Birmingham. We're here to talk about the legend of the Black Mecca, politics, and class in the making of modern Atlanta, Dr. Hobson's recently published book with the University of North Carolina Press. I hope you enjoy. I just have three questions for you, and I'm going to begin with the first one. What ideas are at the heart of the legend of the Black Mecca?
The idea that is at the heart, there's several ideas, but first and foremost, is that not everything is what it seems to be. Atlanta is a unique city for Black people in the United States. However, it is often, it has had to operate in a very conservative state. As a result of that, there have always been tensions. And so, though Atlanta is a unique place for Black people in this country, the story has often been overly embellished. And so one of the things that I do in this book is to look at what is real and what is embellished. So I look at the mix, the myth and the maxim. The second most important thing that should be considered is that if Black people are going to be free and autonomous in this country, you must always outrun discrimination. And discrimination manifests itself in, you know, several different kinds of ways. I mean, sexism, racism, classism. And part of the issue that I'm saying here is that Atlanta's notoriety as a Black Mecca is based on three things. I mean, it's based on Black education, Black economics, and Black political empowerment and electoral politics. Historically, I think there's some other kind of conversations that we can have in terms of expressive culture, different things. Currently. But at some point in time, I mean, you can see this in the most recent mayoral election, you know, Black folk kind of rested on their laurels and thought that they had actually made it. And that's not the case.
Okay. Thank you. You put forward the concept of the New Black South in the book. Can you please say
Black New South.
The Black New South.
Yeah, the Black New South.
The Black New South. Yeah. Sorry about that. Can you say more about the idea?
Yeah, so, and I name it the Black New South. There are a lot of people that will always say the New Black South, but it's actually a play on the idea of Henry Grady's New South. But Henry Grady's New South, when it was presented in the 1880s, was one that talked about industry, but it still marginalized and excluded Black people. It discriminated against Black people. And so what I actually describe here is a conversation around a new South where Black people actually gain something significant from it. And so one of the things that we lay out here is that Atlanta is always kind of pushed into this narrative as being a civil rights battleground because it produced King. And that's absolutely disrespectful. There's no disrespect to Dr. King and all that, you know, he did in the movement, but to suggest that King is the leader and that Atlanta is the brain trust is extremely middle-class sentiment, and it discounts groundswell organizers such as you know, Dorothy Bolden or Edie Nixon or Joanne Robinson or Dorothy Cotton, Fannie Lou Hamer, and you know, other groups that working class and women that kind of remove us from this idea of a charismatic Black male leader that is middle class. And so what happens in this is currently there's a debate in the field of history around, you know, the classical phase of the civil rights movement, 1954, Brown v. Board of Education, to 1965 or 1968. which includes the Voting Rights Act of 1965 coming out of Selma and for the assassination of Dr. King. However, more up-to-date social historians understand that civil and human rights have always been an issue in the Western Hemisphere for African-descended people. And so with this being said, what I do in the Black New South is what we cannot deny is how the Civil Rights Act of 1964 coming out of Birmingham, Alabama, and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 coming out of Selma, Alabama, politically changed the American South. And the epitome of that is a Maynard Jackson's election. Like, it basically, this is what really kind of propels, because you have Black folks with the Civil Rights Act of 64, which buttresses citizenship, and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which grants universal suffrage, you begin to see Black people operate in their own interest. And what is also happening at this point in time is that Black folk that have left the American South due to the Great Migrations over, you know, generations of historical periods, begin to understand that cities such as Chicago or Cleveland or New York or Boston were not the cities that they were not the promised land that they were set to be, because industry was shrinking. It was very difficult to get involved in industry. What you also have is a movement called the Sunbelt Movement, where we begin to see the creation of technical jobs, and this is primarily in the American South. It's from Southern Virginia across the nation to California, and so because of property taxes being, you know, cheaper in the American South, you see a boom where we move into post-industrial conditioning and the creation of the information age, and so technical jobs become more prevalent here. What's also going on here is that because of historically Black colleges, about 98% of them being located in the former Confederacy, former American South, you have those, the children of those that migrated to the Midwest, the Northeast, and out West that come back to the American South to go to historically Black colleges. What happens here is someone like a Maynard Jackson is able to galvanize young people that are coming to the Atlanta University Center, also the reverse migrations, reverse great migrations of Black folk moving back to the American South because of the civil rights legislation that opened or knocked down particular barriers. And Jackson is able to galvanize on a new Black electorate along with a large Black electorate and then a white progressive electorate that was present in the city. And that's what moves Maynard Jackson to become the city's first Black mayor. So the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65 kind of changes the idea and presents the American South as the last frontier, and that is the result of the Black New South.
Thank you. I read that one of your goals is to further explore the theory of Atlanta as part of a global South. Can you please explain that notion?
Yes. So the idea of the global South is, I mean, so historically, the U.S. will always present itself as not participating in colonialism, but and the reason that it presents itself as such is because the United States has the American South, which is colonialism. And so what we're talking about is, you know, semantics and words and all kind of different things. But basically what I'm discussing is, I mean, and it's not just Atlanta. We're talking about the American South. There are conversations that state that the Gulf Coast is the northernmost point of the Caribbean. Same people dropped off in different places, which goes into Latin America, goes into South America, and even, you know, connects to the continent of Africa. But what we're talking about here is this idea of Atlanta's international notoriety as a Black Mecca. And this spawns from several different things. I mean, on one level, we talk about Black education, Black economics, and Black political empowerment, electoral politics, as well as expressive culture. But you also have some things that kind of move about to where when Maynard Jackson and Andrew Young were mayors they opened particular things up to the Caribbean, South America, and the African continent. And the city of Atlanta began to do business with, you know, these Caribbean nations, South American nations, and African nations, as well as some Asian nations. And what this does is it creates a confluence of African descended people coming to Atlanta and seeing this idea of this is a black global city. So the black world has citizenship in Atlanta. They see it as, you know, liberated territory where black people can go. I'm interested in doing some work on Rio de Janeiro and Atlanta, both Olympic cities, both cities with a large underclass, both cities where sex sells, serious, you know, issues in terms of urban blight and caste and class. I'm also interested in doing a comparative study of Salvador Bahia in Brazil, known as the Black Mecca of South America, and Atlanta as the Black Mecca of the United States. We're also interested in partnering with other. I've recently made contact with the Center for African Cities, to where we're looking at the influx on how Atlanta can be seen as an African city, and this is all a part of the Global South. The conditions of the American South in terms of racism, classism, in terms of policies that were created to restrict, are not just in the American South, but this is something that occurs in Latin America, the Caribbean, South America, West Africa, and parts of Asia. And so Atlanta's notoriety in terms of partnering in this conversation around the Global South is one that rears its head as resistance against white supremacy.
Wow, okay. That's interesting, and I can't wait to read what you have written and explore what you're thinking about more in the future on that concept of Atlanta as part of a Global South. Are there any last words that you'd like to share?
I have a gift that I've been called to promote and disseminate the histories and cultures of African descended people. And one of the things that I suggest is that I'm an extremely interdisciplinary scholar. I'm a historian trained in political science, sociology, and economics. And one of the reasons I promote this idea of interdisciplinary black studies is because oftentimes the narratives of black people are not found in archives. And as a result of that, you have to have different methods to be able to tell stories. One of the things I do promote is that I would suggest that, you know, our members really spend time in the archives, because archives are where you can create new histories, new knowledge spaces, you know, for us to learn. So, you know, I just really hope that, you know, the community that has an interest in the field of African American history, that they really kind of search out, instead of being consumers of knowledge, they become producers of knowledge. And go into the archives, you know, collect oral histories to really kind of tell our story and to recreate our story in a fashion that is nuanced in ways to where it does express, you know, the beautiful history and culture of black people, the beautiful and ugly histories of African descended people.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Once again, I'm Dr. Kenja McCray, and we've been talking with Dr. Maurice Hobson about his new book, The Legend of the Black Mecca, Politics and Class in the Making of Modern Atlanta, which the University of North Carolina Press published in November 2017.